This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending the 17th of August 2018. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 17th of August, which this week have been edited by Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent. Your readers today are Nikki Baring.
Hello.
Norma York.
Hello.
And Albie Minns.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. Now, the main headlines this week: culture idea for sports centre site, a booming good time for revellers despite the rain, and opposition grows to power station plan. So, Nikki, may we have the story behind the first headline, please?
Which is culture idea for sports centre site. Winchester's civic chief wants to see a cultural development on the site of the River Park Leisure Centre. The centre on Gordon Road will become redundant when the new sport and leisure centre is built on playing fields at Bar End, subject to planning permission. If things go smoothly, the City Council believes work on the new centre could start in early 2019, with completion in 2021. City Council leader Caroline Horrell said, "I like the idea of cultural arts use. It is next to the School of Art and near the city centre." An IPG, informal policy group, will be set up in September, said Councillor Horrell, to hear ideas before a report is prepared for Cabinet. Interested parties will be able to tell city councillors what they would like to see on the site. The tennis courts, artificial pitches, mainly used for football, and the indoor bowls centre are unaffected by the plans. Letters to the Chronicle have suggested a decent-sized concert hall, something the city lacks. Keith Lehman, chairman of the City of Winchester Trust, the city's main civic society, when asked what the preservation watchdogs thought, said he agreed with Councillor Horrell. "We know there is a possibility of it being considered for the site of a museum for the Anglo-Saxon period. Others would like to see a Turner Sims-type concert hall. Whether that is economically viable, I don't know." The Turner Sims Hall at Southampton University has a capacity for around 500 seats. Mr. Lehman said he would prefer something cultural rather than houses. "If you look at what the city has to offer, the cathedral, the Great Hall, Winchester College, it seems to lack a few of the things that make it a cultural centre. Visitors expect more when they come here and are slightly disappointed by what else there is. The growth of the city's student population in recent years has made a cultural centre more viable."
A booming good time for revellers despite the rain. A wet and wild finish marked the end of another brilliant and bizarre boomtown last night. The four-day festival held at Matterley Estate near Winchester was brought to a climatic end in torrential rain, but that did little to dampen the spirits of revellers at the popular music event. On Sunday night, thousands braved the downpour as the festival's big-name closing acts prepared to take the stage. They included the likes of British electronic duo Marabou State and iconic American rap rock band Limp Bizkit. Multi-Grammy Award winner Ben Harper, famous for mixing genres including blues, folk and soul, was also due to take the stage. Drum and bass stars Andy C and legendary British group Chase and Status were among those rumoured to be lined up for the secret slot. The climatic finish followed trouble-free few days for the festival, which last year was criticised for long queues and in 2016 was clouded by the death of an 18-year-old and a fire which destroyed 82 cars. But it was a brilliant music and the festival's ever-creative stages which made the headlines this year. And of all the acts to perform, it was the world-famous group Grizzilla who drew the biggest audience. Former Blur frontman Damon Albarn's virtual alternative rock wowed fans with a two-hour set, ending with a simple message to the sodden fans: "Boomtown, you've been a dream." There were plenty of other acts for the 60,000 fans to enjoy across the main 4 days. Among them were the Warsaw-born musician Goldie, alternative rockers Enter Sicari, and the electronic punk duo Sleaford Mods. This year was the first year the festival was given the go-ahead for a fifth day, open to fans who travelled to the ground by sustainable transport. Through Monday, thousands of bleary-eyed revellers took the shuttle bus from the site through the city centre to the train station. There were no reports of any serious traffic problems, unlike previous years. The event was a 60,000-person sellout, with all tickets going by the end of February. Now the clean-up begins to return the land to agricultural use for the next 10 months. And there are numerous photographs, which I'm not even going to try to describe, other than to say that they were very colourful, with a range of bizarre outfits. And some of them have very little clothing on. It must have been a bit chilly in all that rain.
Opposition grows to power station plan. Campaigners have stepped up their fight against plans to build a gas-powered power station in the countryside. Nearly 400 objections have been lodged against the scheme, which would be built on land next to Locke's Farm in Botley Road, Bishop's Waltham, if approved. However, the planning permission being sought for the standby facility would only run for the next 25 years. Bishop's Waltham Parish Council is among the objectors. Its letter said, "The application does not meet the criteria for a development in the countryside and would cause harm to the character and landscape of the area. The proposal would likely result in unacceptable pollution, resulting in adverse health or quality of life impacts." The Parish Council Planning Committee also registered its disappointment in the lack of full public consultation. Hampshire and Isle of Wight Wildlife Trust, HIOWTT, also objected over adverse effects on nearby ancient woodland, and the Moors SSSI, site of special scientific interests. A Facebook group also has been set up to fight the plans, with more than 300 people backing it. However, environmental consultants Enzigo, on behalf of applicant NGFP Limited, say the proposed facility will contribute to providing a key source of flexibility to help address some of the challenges associated with the transition to a low-carbon electricity sector. They added, the facility will respond to calls from National Grid when energy demand outstrips supply. By being able to generate energy immediately and for a short length of time, the development will help the energy sector cope with the peaks in demand for energy they face on a daily basis. The application has so far received two letters of support from Bishop's Waltham residents. Leslie Ewells of Tangier Lane said, "It appears to offer a much-needed amenity with minimal negative impact on the surrounding area. I hope to be moving to a new housing development relatively close to the proposed facility, so we'll be one of the nearest neighbours and can see no reason why it should be refused." And there's a plan of the proposed site taken from a satellite, I think, and shows a lot of green land, which probably wouldn't be there after the power station has been built.
Thank you. That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements, followed by Christian comment, letters to the editor, historical items, chronicle comment, and first person and Belgarum. And then we do the announcements and what's on. So we start with the death announcements this week. Compton, Frederick John Compton, who died peacefully on the 5th of August, aged 89. Cross, Jennifer Cross, née Scott, died peacefully on the 6th of August at Bramer Lodge, Salisbury. Dare, Alan Dare, who died peacefully on the 9th of August. Francis Stephen Leslie James Francis died on the 5th of August, aged 39. Hall Ella Hall, who died peacefully on the 8th of August, aged 97. Howes Mary Joy Howes died peacefully on the 2nd of August, aged 91. Pemberton, Jolene Joyce Pemberton, née Berner, who died on the 29th of July, aged 26. Richardson, Linda Richardson, died on the 8th of August after a short illness. And Smith, Angela Smith, née Forbes, who died peacefully at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, aged 60. And now we have Christian comment read by Albie.
Yes, Christian comment this week comes from the Reverend Dr. Philip Crinks, priest in charge, Parish of St. Faith, St. Cross Hospital, under the heading Loving God with a Mother's Love. This week in France and Southern Europe, people are enjoying extra public holidays. For Brits abroad, these can be a source of surprise and even annoyance. People down tools, shops and markets close, villages turn to festivals and celebrations. For centuries, English people did the same. We also maintained the long tradition of honouring the memory of Mary, the mother of Jesus, in the middle of August. In the 16th century, all this changed. The Reformation movement sought to renew the church. It emphasised that it was to God alone we should give the glory. Devotions inspired by Mary and other saints could create confusion about who God was. They diluted the proper worship of the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Divisions among Christians about Mary's role continued for many years. Yet over recent decades, Christians of all traditions have been thinking about Mary in new ways. One way to think about Mary is that as Christ's mother, she had a unique relationship with him. She saw God as no one else before or after has seen him. She saw God with a mother's eyes. She saw him with a mother's love. If that was possible for Mary, a Middle Eastern peasant woman, it is possible for us. Our Christmas celebrations rightly focus on the innocent joy of Mary's first days with Jesus. Yet there is no room for sentimentality when we reflect on Mary. Mothering is costly. Many of us know these costs. We know them as birth mothers, adopted mothers, foster mothers, carers, teachers. We know them as grandparents, fathers, uncles, brothers, who are called to show a child a mother's love. The cost of mothering can be counted in blood, sweat, and tears. Within weeks of Jesus' birth, Mary and Joseph took him to the temple. The prophet Simeon told Mary that in her mothering, a sword would pierce her soul. 30 years later, at the end of Jesus' earthly ministry, Mary would be among the women standing at the foot of the cross as Jesus suffered and died in his love for the human beings who were created through him. Mary is honoured for her first obedience to God's call, her yes to God. She is honoured also for being faithful to the end. Roman Catholic Christians maintain the tradition, rejected by the Reformers, that at the end of Mary's life, she was assumed into heaven in the flesh. The traditional date for this was August the 15th. As Mary was the first to say yes to God's plan in Christ, she was also the first to be with Christ in heaven in the flesh. A mother's love brings a mother's costs and a mother's rewards. If we can love God and those he calls us to care for, as Mary did, then we also can reach our own lives' ends with hearts content and in joyful anticipation of heaven.
Thank you. That concludes the Christian comment. Now we're moving to letters to the editor. We have a selection of those. First one by Nikki. Thank you.
And the first from Roger Stevens in Compton, headed Sacrosanct. Sir, I read George Hollingbury's letter from Westminster, Chronicle, July 26, with some interest, but little optimism. I congratulate him on his appointment as Minister for Trade, policy in the latest ministerial merry-go-round, and salute his endeavour to make the best of a bad job. His task is to replace the international deals that the EU has made. Population, 500 million. Economy, 16 trillion euros. With deals that the UK can make. Population, 66 million. Economy, 2.3 trillion euros. With only 1/8 of the clout of the EU, there is no chance of forging a better deal, or even the equivalent of what we have now. He revealed that he voted to remain in the referendum, presumably because he thought this was the better option. What has caused him to change his mind? Or is he pursuing a course that he knows is not in the UK's best interest, because the people have spoken? 2 years after the referendum, we still do not know what Brexit is. But during those 2 years, we have discovered that the £350 million dividend for the NHS was a misspoke. The various Brexit organisations illegally colluded, overspent, employed a disgraced media company that used stolen personal data, and had multiple dealings with the Russian embassy. Is he sure that none of the Leave voters simply wanted to give the despised government a flying kick where it hurts most? Yet at a time of furious national disagreement, the whole nation still regards the narrow referendum result as sacrosanct. There exists in public life a very noisy group of hard Brexiteers. They are all very rich, some are not resident in the UK, and several have assets abroad through a complex maze of companies. Why? None of them have any specific responsibilities in UK government, but all have enormous influence through the indulgence of the media. They have power without responsibility. History is harsh to those who do know right from wrong, but wash their hands and bow to the demands of the braying mob. That from Roger Stevens, Cliffway, Compton.
Not another. Sir, in 1989, one of the important rural issues of the time was provision of affordable housing, so the Hampshire Council of Community Services, HCCS, set up an affordable housing forum with a remit to find suitable land. Its membership included HCCS chairman, chief rural officer, district council's estate officers, and a Southampton University professor. Their report stated that the main problem was the lack of land because no council-owned land was available, and developers were buying up all the accessible land they could, obtaining planning permission and then hoarding it until it was in their interest to develop it. In 2012, after a long battle, planning permission was granted for building 2,000 dwellings on Barton Farm, primarily because 800 of these would be affordable social housing. Today, the affordable element will still take 10 years to complete and will not fulfil the present need. Ian Tate, the former Winchester City Councillor, was always an advocate of this development, but is now proposing a second Barton Farm. A city council scheme, primarily affordable housing, Hampshire Chronicle, August the 9th. Surely he realises that the city council could not possibly fund a large development of affordable housing. There would not be enough profit in it for a developer, and it would create a ghetto. An outdated concept? He says he's working with a number of firms as they try to develop sites across the district, and claims he is a friend of good development and a friend of affordable housing. There is very little evidence that he has achieved this in the 19 years he was in the council in Winchester, where even the few housing developments that have been completed contain an affordable component are beyond the financial reach of the most people who work in the city, Winchester needs affordable housing urgently, but not another Barton Farm. And that was from Vera E. Bruty, Manningford Close, Abbots Barton, Winchester.
Now a letter from Karen McCleary of Hookpit Farm Lane, Kingsworthy. And it comes under the heading, A Bright Future. Sir, as we prepare to say goodbye to Brussels, the positives are clear. Britain will be leaving a profoundly undemocratic institution. We will regain national sovereignty, have the freedom to seek new trade deals, freedom to manage our own justice system, and the freedom to better manage migration. We will be unshackling ourselves from the high tax, high spend policies endemic in the EU. Before joining the common market, Britain traded successfully worldwide, and this will happen again. Current Project Fear talk of stockpiling food, restricted flights across European airspace, queues at borders with no medicines being imported is ludicrous. I don't see this happening in countries adjacent to, but not part of, the EU, such as Switzerland or Turkey. Sally Penton, Chronicle Letters, July 26, wrote of this intellectually advanced and cooperative organisation which has maintained peace in post-war Europe. Funny that, I thought it was NATO and the UN which had kept the peace. The EU did nothing to promote peace during the Balkans conflict, and in 1982, our French European allies supplied Argentina with Exocet missiles, which killed a large number of British forces in the Falklands. At the same time, another European ally, Spain, increased the pressure over Gibraltar. So much for European cooperation. Do intellectually advanced cooperatives treat member states with as little respect as shown towards Greece when it tried exiting the euro? Should intellectually advanced cooperatives use the delicate peace in Northern Ireland as a bargaining chip in negotiations? When Edna Kenny was Irish Taoiseach, he was clear that technology, flexibility and goodwill would solve Irish border issues. Monsieur Juncker and Barnier are leaning heavily on the current Taoiseach to ensure the border is a major obstacle to positive negotiations. Rather than be seen as a negative, Brexit is a hugely positive populist movement which will enable Britain to trade imaginatively and profitably with 167 countries that are not in the EU and regain the ability to make its own laws under an accountable, democratically elected parliament. Our future could not be brighter.
And from Davina Spinney, Secretary, Alsford Chamber of Commerce. Turn parking. Sir, the Alsford Chamber of Commerce would like to formally respond to several letters published in the Letters to the Editor section. There are a number of inaccuracies that the Chamber would like to address. Research shows that the town's one-hour bays have a very quick turnover compared to the two-hour bays. The one-hour bays turnover between 3 to 4 cars per hour. However, the ones near the only two remaining banks, Building Society, are often more. With several disabled parking bays and 4 bus stops, the town plan has tried to cater for all resident and visitors. At no time has the Chamber ever prevented anyone from parking. In fact, it is in our very interest to encourage people to the town. Whilst the Chamber fully supports the town bus and has no wish to impede the frail or disabled from gaining access to the community centre, it has been brought to our attention by numerous businesses that excessive use has been made of the cones to block two bays often not associated with the bus. These bays, by the only bank and building society in town, have a particularly fast turnover, generally 20 to 30 cars a day. Any police cones or general cones removed by the police or parking enforcement are due to the fact that they are illegally blocking a parking bay and obstructing its lawful use. We are acutely aware that parking in our town can be extremely difficult and will continue to be closely involved with future solutions and plans to ensure that everyone benefits, residents, visitors and businesses alike. More recently, the Chamber has worked hard to protect parking for everyone, especially recently on the Dean, by liaising with builders and directors to ensure the bays are kept as free as possible during the current building works. It is important to note that the Chamber has initiated a meeting with the key parking leads for the town and WCC to discuss the town parking plan and the recent issues outside the community centre to ensure a sensible and agreeable solution for all can be quickly found and agreed. Davina Spinney, Secretary, Alresford Chamber of Commerce.
Eye for the future. Sir, I feel I must speak in defence of the Chesil Lodge, as there have been many critical letters to the editor in the last year about the so-called failure of its architectural design. I was born, brought up and educated in Winchester. I have walked the historical pavements and lived with the city's past all my life. Now, with retirement to look forward to and plan for, I'm excited at the prospect of spending time revisiting my childhood haunts. However, new historical design is being created every day. Chesil Street has an ancient past. Its history cannot be doubted and should never be forgotten. But we need the architectural design of Winchester's new buildings to have an eye to the future as well as a nod to the past. Winchester needs fresh life breathing into it and a move away from standard architecture where the design blends blandly into its neighbours is refreshing. For those of us who take pleasure in straight lines and squarenesses, Chesil Lodge is a perfect example of how simple, modern architecture can still uplift the soul. After more than 18 months of waiting, my mum has just moved into the lodge and I can assure the editor that the flat was worth waiting for. It's lovely on the inside as it is on the outside. And that's from Angela Goodridge, Birchgrove, Boyot Wood, Eastleigh.
Now we have a letter from Simon Lever, Juniper Close, Badger Farm, Winchester, under the heading Embrace Future. Sir, cooperation with the University of Winchester and the City Council to promote the use of technology with the aim of supporting local businesses and, most important, attracting and retaining young talent is positive news. Hampshire Chronicle, August the 2nd. Digital technology is evolving so quickly that those enterprises that embrace the challenges in a positive manner will enhance Winchester's appeal as an ideal location to create long-term jobs. Even in this technology-dominated world, the human dimension is essential. Engaging with potential employees and their existing staff, hiring companies must recognise that people must take precedence over the elimination of frontline jobs. Efficiency must also deliver effectiveness. Human interaction, listening and analytical skills, empathy and a genuine smile will enhance the success and indeed reputation of Winchester as a beacon of opportunity for young people wishing to enter the digital technology sector with a refreshingly human dimension.
Thank you. Now we're going to step back in time 200 years, Nikki.
Dated Monday, August the 17th, 1818. A man named Taylor, formerly a master breeches maker near the Marine Barracks, Portsmouth, was lately employed by Mr. Marshall, breeches maker of this city, to make two pairs of leather breeches, which he did, but instead of taking them back to his employer, sold them to a pawnbroker in the High Street, afterwards absconded and has not been heard of since.
100 years ago today, Saturday the 17th of August 1918, it is proposed to ask the Mayor of Winchester to call a public meeting of citizens to discuss the question of the proposed drastic changes at the west front of the cathedral. A petition lies at the Chronicle office for a signature. Adult citizens of both sexes are earnestly asked to append their names. And secondly, Standing Joint Committee. The committee, in their report, stated that they had directed the allowance to constables using their own bicycles to be increased from £3 to £4 a year. The Chief Constable has laid before the committee petitions from each of the police divisions, calling attention to the further rise in the cost of living since the date when the last war allowance was fixed, July 1917. And the committee have reconsidered the whole question. The force is much depleted, being 172 men short of its full strength, and this depletion renders it impossible for the constables to have the weekly rest day, besides involving additional hours of duty.
Two items from 50 years ago. Saturday, August the 17th, 1968. First item. A 12-foot square mosaic discovered 4 years ago at the Romano-British excavations near Sparsholt, just outside Winchester, will deteriorate beyond repair unless it is removed from exposure into safety. An appeal for part of the £1,500 needed to raise the mosaic and transport it piece by piece to the City Museum, Winchester, was launched this week under the auspices of the Hampshire Field Club. The mosaic is constructed in an extremely intricate geometric pattern with unique forms in each corner and is unusual in being almost intact. It was made by a provincial floor maker in the late 3rd century AD, and not, like many other similar examples, by a visiting Roman craftsman. Mr. J.R. Dockrell, Secretary of the Sparsholt Appeals Committee, said, "The mosaic has got to come up, or it will be destroyed. If we have not got the money by next year, we will lose it." And the second item, Winchester City's Council's plans to stop the demolition of a terrace of four houses in Southgate Street has been rejected by the Minister of Housing and Local Government. The Minister's view is that the buildings are not of sufficient merit to justify the confirmation of a building preservation order made by the City Council. The preservation order was made by the City Council earlier this year, after they had been asked for their reaction to a proposal to demolish numbers 37 and 39, the former offices of the Hampshire Executive Council of the National Health Service. Also included were the two other houses in the terrace, numbers 33 and 35. On July the 2nd, a ministry inspector conducted a local inquiry in Winchester when the City Council sought confirmation of their order.
And from 25 years ago, Friday, August the 13th, 1993. Two items. The first, conservationists are making an 11th hour bid to block plans to develop Winchester's Peninsula Barrack with an alternative scheme of their own. They claim their proposals for the Prestige site would greatly lower the density of the development and open it up for the people of Winchester to walk through and enjoy. A coalition of some of the most prominent people in conservation in Hampshire, together with Marcus Binney of Save Britain's Heritage, say they view with horror the scheme to which Winchester City planners are due to give the green light next month. They're planning to hold a public meeting to show what is proposed and to display to councillors an alternative scheme that they say would develop the site in a more sympathetic manner. They're aiming to preserve the barracks buildings and their history, to make provision for new uses, and to complete a necklace of walks from the cathedral to the upper barracks. Hugh Thomas, the architect who is spearheading the attempt to stop the city plans, said, "Hampshire Buildings Preservation Trust, Winchester Preservation Trust, and other conservation groups like the Victorian Society will, I am confident, be supportive." He added, "One of the reasons that so little fuss has been made is that the barracks is effectively a sealed-off secret place. The scheme we are opposing is dangerously close to getting planning permission. Once that is given, we will lose this large open space." And the second item, a former Winchester mayor is backing maverick landowner Alfie Cole in a campaign to provide transit sites for New Age travellers in Hampshire. Long-serving city councillor and JP, Fred Allgood, has responded positively to a request for support from the Mitchell Dever landowner, who is currently locked in a legal battle with the Winchester Council's solicitors. Mr. Cole incurred the wrath of the City Council last month after allowing over 40 travellers to park their caravans on the site without getting planning permission. Mr. Allgood commented, "Throughout Hampshire we have a problem with travellers. They gatecrash onto recreation grounds and landowners' fields. The City Council has to spend a lot of council taxpayers' money chasing them away from areas where they're not wanted. If there are landowners who are willing to look after them for a short period of time, this will take the pressure off the rest of us in Hampshire. This would seem a sensible solution, and I'm in favour of other landowners coming forward." He added that he had not had a chance to examine the pros and cons of Mr. Cole's controversial site at Coxford Down near Mitchell Dever Station, and therefore reserved his opinion on its suitability. He said, "I haven't seen a plan yet, but if Mr. Cole does submit a planning application, I would be very happy to go and have a look at it." And now we have editorial comment, I think. Nikki.
Headed, "What to Replace the Leisure Centre." Observers of the Winchester scene may be forgiven for a slight feeling, not of boredom exactly, but weariness at the proposals to revamp the city centre, officially known as the Central Winchester Regeneration, but more widely known as Silver Hill 2. The scheme has been in gestation since the late 1990s, when Stagecoach started to express interest in redeveloping the bus station. The first scheme collapsed, and now things are starting to simmer with the agreement of the planning framework that in theory should guide the concrete proposals. However, everyone can get excited about the ideas for how the River Park Leisure Centre will be transformed, the subject of the front page story. With the sports centre heading to Bar End once planning permission is given, that leaves a large 1980s sports centre. Many of the sports facilities will stay, such as the tennis courts, football pitch, and the Riverside Indoor Bowling Club, which opened in 1997. But a large building would be surplus to sporting requirements. Council leader Caroline Horrell wants it replaced with something cultural. The former High Sheriff, Alan Lovell, has suggested it is the site for an Anglo-Saxon museum that would tell the story of the development of the English language. Everyone will have their ideas. The City Council is launching an informal policy group next month to hear them. Here's a chance to have your say.
Thank you, now we have first person, Norma.
And this is by Joanna Lewis, excuse me, who says, "Covering up for men. How do you solve a problem like the niqab? Certainly not by Tory MPs channeling Donald Trump. Boris Johnson is now an infamous newspaper article which included measured liberal views but also silly schoolboy jibes, have made more young Muslim women cover their faces and will make voicing concerns about women's rights with hardline Islamism vulnerable to charges of Islamophobia. Personally, I don't think it's part of a functioning, secular, multicultural society based on gender equality to have women cover their faces in public. It's not practical at a basic level. But I totally respect the cultural expression of Muslim female dress and modesty. In fact, I went out of my way to conform to it recently. I have just returned from field work in a conservative Muslim country. Having always loved a headscarf and been a fan of the kaftan, a la Liz Taylor in Cleopatra, I enthusiastically arrived with a suitcase full of them. The reality proved less glamorous. A period of transition unfolded, shall we say, waiting in the Dubai airport terminal for regional flights to the Middle East and Horn of Africa. I spotted an old woman pushing a heavy trolley packed high with cases she struggled to control. Head to toe in black, complete with train and hanging sleeves, her dress caused her to pause and trip. Shocking to me was that her lower face seemed to be covered by a metal restraint. Every feminist bone in my body flinched. The scarf stayed in the bag. Could I submit? On the next plane, I was one of only two European women. She had scarved up, the same as every other Somali woman on the plane, headscarves perfectly tied to frame the face. Just before we landed, I did the same. It felt fine. But it wasn't that simple to conform. My scarves kept slipping off my head. Scarves had to cover not only hair, but ears, necks and the upper body. My kaftans were either not long enough, exposed too much arm, or in the wrong light, suddenly went see-through. It was like Bridget Jones does Mecca. 2 days later, I was bartering down in the souk. I bought a black bonnet to keep my hair in place, had Pavarotti-style kaftans made, and left wearing more safety pins than the Sex Pistols. All the women I interviewed wore scarves. They looked stylish, professional, and beautiful in their bright colours. I discovered a huge range of options and opinions. Some wore jeans underneath. Older women, who had been young professionals in Mogadishu and Hurghada in the 1970s and worn afro, lamented the increase in covering up. Women had necks and faces when we were young, they said. A few young women smiled knowingly at the women wearing the niqab. Some want to show they've travelled abroad to Saudi, they confided, or they were shielding faces from the sun as light skin still considered more attractive. Others were sympathetic, since they'd left London partly to protect daughters from misogynistic, sexualised urban rap culture. Clearly, wearing the niqab doesn't mean that you have got a boyfriend in Al-Sabab. Note, lots of the closet liberal Muslim women want to loosen controls and ensure girls are educated in an environment where they are not restricted by conservative customs or dress. I know smart young Muslim women in this country trying to have conversations with men about women's rights based on their own reading of the Muslim theology. Will the current atmosphere silence them? I hope not. If we try, this political furore could be an opportunity to learn about and tackle the reasons behind face covering. I discovered that the women who'd shocked me at the airport were Borgay from Iran. Masking started centuries ago when women embroidered masks to look like men with moustaches in order to repel invaders. Johnson's childish remarks in his article were about advancing his political ambitions, not women. Let's not cover up for men anymore.
Thank you. Now we've got a couple of items from Belgarum, Albie.
Yes, the first item, crane towers over High Street. A striking new addition to the Winchester skyline has appeared this week. The crane will tower over the High Street for the next few weeks as part of the construction of the Travel Lodge on the High Street. Workmen have cleared the site between Rickstein and Debenhams to allow the crane to bring in the steel frame, and it's photographed. An enormous T-shaped crane, steel, towering over the adjacent housing. Formidable. And the second item, parked up and ready to go at Barton Farm. That's a serious group of heavy machinery parked up at the King's Barton Farm development on the edge of Winchester at the weekend. The machines, tractors, diggers and dumper trucks, were lined up like Indians on the Brava Hill on the southern end of the development, next to where the rerouted Andover Road will swing into the estate. The topsoil has been removed to reveal the strikingly white chalk below. The vehicles were parked close to the area that had been prone to flooding and so will not be developed for housing. And there's another photograph of the serious group of heavy machinery parked at the King's Barton Farm development on the edge of Winchester. The tractors, the diggers, the dumper trucks, all lined up like Indians on the Brava Hill.
Thank you. Now we move on to announcements, and we start with what's on. And there's some shows and fates to let you know about. Saturday the 1st of September, lots of choices. Littleton and Hairstock Show, that runs from midday till 5 o'clock at Littleton Recreation Ground, with a dog gymkhana, jazz band, majorettes, the Spitfire Sisters, and stalls and fairground attractions. The same day, Saturday the 1st of September, there's Alsford Agricultural Show, which is at Titchbourne. That's between 9 and 5. It's a large agricultural show with poultry, livestock, vintage machinery. Tickets for that are £15. The same day at Shawford and Compton, there's the Shawford and Compton Horticultural Society with its annual show, and that starts at 2:30 on Saturday, September the 1st, and it's residents entering competitions including homecraft, that's cakes, tarts, jams, handicraft, and young persons, refreshments, raffle, with free admission. And anyone who wants to take part in that can contact Elaine Pape on 7122321 beforehand for entry forms. On August the 26th, which is Sunday, there's Eastern Fate, and that's rather than the usual bank holiday Monday, it's on the Sunday. So that's 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Eastern Village Hall and Cricket Ground, and that will have vintage tractor and donkey rides, bouncy castle, jousting, children's games, races and a dog show. That's £2 entry. And finally, an early reminder really for the Saturday the 8th of September, Romsey Show is at Broadlands, and that's got Great Wall Flying Display, vintage vehicles, parade of livestock, heavy horse parade, and tickets for that are £17 on the gate, or I think it's only £14 if you get advance purchases from various outlets or online. Now, lighting up time ends Friday the 17th of August at 5:55 a.m. and begins at 8:23 p.m. And on Wednesday the 22nd of August, it ends at 6:03 a.m. and begins at 8:12 p.m. And if you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive the recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870370. That's Irene Dowding on 01962 870370. And now we continue with items of general news. Nikki.
And this headed, Kramer opens new salon in new chain. Acclaimed hairdresser Guy Kramer has opened a second Hampshire salon as he plans to create a franchise chain across the southwest. With the help of a finance package from HSBC, Guy has opened an outlet in Lymington. The business has used the funding, comprised of a six-figure commercial mortgage and six-figure business loan, to purchase and refurbish a 1,200-square-foot former restaurant. The new premises will include a hair salon with a cafe lounge and courtyard. It will create up to 10 jobs, including hairstylists and cafe staff. Guy also plans to open more franchise salons across the southwest as part of a five-year plan with HSBC UK. Colin Boyce, Guy Kramer business partner, said, Guy has run a successful salon for decades, building an impressive portfolio of clients in Winchester and around the world. We are thrilled to open a new salon in Lymington so we can replicate our success. Jane Fancy, HSBC's UK's area director, said, We are delighted to be able to support the business in acquiring this property. Guy and Colin have ambitious plans for growth across the southwest, and we're keen to be able to support them in the next stage of the business's development. Guy, who has owned a salon in Winchester for 40 years, is a L'Oreal ambassador and includes celebrities among his clientele. He has also contributed towards top fashion magazines. And we have a photograph outside the Winchester salon, oh no, the Lymington salon, of Guy Kramer, salon in Lymington, J.C. Ocon, Colin Boyce, managing director of Guy Kramer, Steve Gardner, HSBC relationship manager, and Guy Kramer. And I don't know why I've noticed it, but they all have their hands in their pockets. A modern way of posing, I think.
Town fire engine returns to its base. Restored vintage fire engine will be centrepiece of the new museum in Alsford. 80 years after the last fire engine left the old fire station in Alsford, the building will once again house a fire appliance. One of the old Merriweather steamer pump appliances built in the 1890s and similar to that operating in Alsford in the early part of the 20th century will be moving into the old fire station on Saturday, August the 18th. The fire engine will not have travelled far over the last 100 years as it was originally used on the Tichborne Park estate and for many years has been housed at the fire station on Pound Hill. It will be transferred to the newly refurbished Broad Street Fire Station, which was built in 1881, and housed the town's fire brigade and their equipment up until 1938, when the new fire station was completed. The old fire station is owned by the New Alsford Town Trust, which has refurbished the original part of the building that formed the fire station to house the new Alsford Museum. The original idea was to create exhibition and display space for local historical artefacts in the old fire station, but when the possibility of actually housing a local vintage fire engine became a reality, our plans changed, said Roy Gentry, chairman of the Alsford and District Museum Trust. Our focus now will be on preparing suitable displays to complement the fire engine and open the museum to the public. We are grateful to the Hampshire Fire Service, Allen House and the Hampshire Police and Fire Heritage Trust for their help in making this project a reality. The fire engine originally came into the possession of the Hankin family in the 1960s and was housed in the fire station on Pound Hill when Alex Hankin was Alsford's chief fire officer. The Hankin family spent thousands of pounds restoring the appliance in the early 1990s and John Hankin is delighted it will be staying in the town. There will be a handover of the fire engine at the Pound Hill Fire Station at 2:30 p.m. on August the 18th and all past and present firefighters and local residents are welcome to attend and escort it to its new home, said Roy. In order to successfully display the fire engine and associated artefacts, the museum needs more volunteers. Help is needed to prepare displays, undertake historical research and produce display material, as well as stewards to man the museum when it opens to the public. Anybody who thinks they may be able to help should contact Roy Gentry on 01962 773185. I'll repeat that again, 01962 773185. Town Trustee John Cattle said, "This is something we have long wanted to do. It's nice to get back to where it should be. I have a fire service background. My father-in-law ran the old control room on Andover Road, and my wife and mother-in-law were in the auxiliary fire service. During the 1800s and into the 20th century, in the days when there were no real standards for having or operating a fire brigade, many estate owners and eminent people took the decision to establish their own fire brigades to protect their families, main country house and other estate properties or interests. In the beginning, there were little more than bucket brigades and pumps were of the horse-drawn or hand-pulled manual pumps. requiring up to 16 persons to manually provide the motive power to send water through leather hose pipes. The first steam engine appeared in 1829, but its design never gained any acceptance, and a refined design did not make its reappearance until 1858. One of the two most widely used steamers was made by Merriweather, the manufacturer of the Tichborne Park example, and in 1878 they were boasting that they had sold over 500 of these horse-drawn wonders of the age, which for the first time provided mechanical motive power to a pump capable of producing the sustained and powerful jets of water required to extinguish serious fires. The introduction of the steamer changed the face of firefighting and enabled the firemen of the time to finally save property rather than just reducing spread on one property to another. They continued in use until the early 1920s, by which time the petrol engine was used to drive the pump and transport firemen to the scene. Alsford did have a steam fire engine, again manufactured by Merriweather, and this was delivered on October the 1st, 1908, and given the name of Vulcan, replacing a manual pump which had served the town for previous 50 years. Little is known about the Tichborne Park Fire Brigade, but it is very likely that the steamer replaced a previously used manual pump. And there are some lovely photographs, and the main one is of the engine outside the station on Pound Hill being pulled by two beautiful horses, and the men were in what looked like very heavy uniforms, Wellington boots, and these the metal hats. I expect you, some of you might remember the metal hats that had sort of a curl on the top. And there's numerous pictures of them all standing to attention. And there's another photograph of a very old steam pump fire engine. My goodness, I don't think it would cope with today's fires. But it's a lovely reminder.
Scout heading to World Jamboree. A Winchester teenager has been chosen from thousands of scouts to represent the United Kingdom at an international event next summer. Dylan Evans, 17, will take on the role when he heads across the pond to West Virginia as 45,000 scouts gather for the group's World Jamboree. Taking place in July and August 2019, Dylan will work with youngsters from nearly every country in the world to share life skills and help put on the massive event. Held every 4 years, a World Scout Jamboree is an opportunity that young people in scouting usually only get once. Dylan said, "I'm really looking forward to experiencing West Virginia. I'm aiming to develop my social media skills whilst I work there." TV adventurer and chief scout Bear Grylls added, "Congratulations to Dylan Evans and all the other UK volunteers who've been selected to support scouts at the World Scout Jamboree. While lots of people know that scouting helps young people learn the skills they need for life, they often don't realise that adult volunteers learn just as much as our young members." And there's a photograph of Dylan, head and shoulders, very smart, looking very pleased, and so he should be. Good luck, Dylan. Well done.
Upmarket boutique closes owing creditors £700,000. An upmarket Winchester boutique has closed owing creditors more than £700,000. Maxim's of Winchester on St Thomas Street had been trading in the city since 2009, originally on Stockbridge Road, Full Flood, near the railway station. It specialised in designer clothes and shoes not readily available elsewhere on the High Street. Publicly available figures from Companies House stated that £705,000 was owed to creditors in September 30, 2017, up from £698,703 in September 2016. The owner, Rachel James, was unavailable for comment. A notice on the door of the now empty shop announced its closure and added, "We would like to thank all of our lovely customers for their custom over the last 10 years. The city has seen a number of long-established independent traders go under in recent months, including Wild Sports on Jewellery Street and Creative Crafts on the Square. The rise of internet shopping has been blamed along with cripplingly high rents and business rates. Winchester Business Improvement District points out that the vacancy rate in Winchester is well below the national average. And there are a couple of photographs of the notice on the door and the empty shop, which I never visited, which looks rather good. Pity it's gone.
Our impact on the planet, but it is not yet too late. From a scientific perspective, this is the best of times and the worst of times. It is the best of times because we know now more about the effect mankind is having on the incredible planet than at any time. We can project with a high degree of accuracy the likely impact of the continued loss of species or the increase in carbon monoxide. It is the worst of times because we also know how much we have already lost and how much we will still lose. Take the UK. Just yesterday I was enjoying watching a great white egret on local Hampshire Nature Reserve. Great white egret is a species that originated in the Mediterranean and since the 1990s started to move north as the weather warmed. By 2000 it had become widespread across southern England and is now starting to breed. Great white egret is one of the growing number of species that are not only adapting to the new climate but thriving in it. And in many cases, the south of the UK has become something of a Noah's Ark for species fleeing the heat of Iberia and France. But for every story of resilience, there are at least 10 where the news is not so good. Wherever we look, local wildlife is struggling. According to to BirdLife International, the UK has lost half of its birds since 1966. That is 44 million birds. Put another way, we are losing 2,318 birds in Britain every 24 hours, or about 700 birds in Hampshire each week. For many of our sub-Saharan migrants, it is climate change that is the culprit. But other factors include house building, marine pollution, agricultural change, and freshwater contamination. Take the house martin. They used to be widespread from central Scotland to Cornwall, but in the last 25 years, the bird has disappeared from our towns and cities. According to the British Trust for Ornithology, we have lost most of the large colonies in Hampshire. Some of the change has been to do with the modern building design, where the eaves aren't suitable for nest building. But the biggest culprit is the massive shift in climate, both locally and on the migration routes. And the crisis isn't just a local one. In Germany, 75% of insects have vanished in the last 30 years. In Australia, up to 80% of corals in the north section of the Great Barrier Reef have died since 1990. In South America, every type of amphibian from toads to tree frogs are in rapid decline. No corner of the planet is unaffected. But the story does not stop there. The great white egret tells us something important. Nature is resilient. If we can do our part to create new habitats, even if it's just a few square metres in our churchyard or back garden, we provide nature with a fighting chance. As we keep an eye on the dire global situation, we can continue to be inspired by the local success stories. If we all act locally for wildlife, we can still turn this around. It is not too late.
Village raids probed by the police. Businesses have been targeted in two overnight raids near Stockbridge, with thieves stealing horse accessories and fuel. In the first break-in, offenders entered a stockroom at a commercial premises in North Halton between July 27th and 28th. The thieves stole a number of items in the raid, including horse accessories. In the second incident, which happened between July 29th and 30th, commercial garages were broken into in Leckford. Offenders forced entry into the garages, but police believe only two jerry cans of fuel were stolen. A spokesman for Hampshire Constabulary said, "If you saw or heard anything unusual during these time periods, or have information that could assist police in an investigation, please call 101, quoting the relevant reference numbers. Anyone who has information about the Houghton incident should quote 44180 285 415. And for Leckford, 44180 287 315, via contacting police through 101.
Couples' round-the-world adventures. Bronwyn and John Vancombe had always wanted to travel, but with two children and challenging jobs involving long hours and tiring commutes, their options were limited. But they could dream. John yearned to take part in the round-the-world yacht race, while Bronwyn wanted to volunteer at an animal sanctuary in Namibia that she'd read about. 2 years ago, the couple from Swanmore, both aged 54, decided to take the first big step towards making their dreams come true by leaving their jobs and setting up their own property management business, giving themselves more flexibility. And the pair have just returned from an adventure of a lifetime, with John taking part in an almost year-long round-the-world yacht race and Bronwyn travelling the world too, working remotely, volunteering and being there to meet him every time his yacht came into port. "John dreamt of doing something like this, but never thought he'd be able to," said Bronwyn, who admits that the couple still haven't adjusted to their adventures being over, for now at least. John had limited sailing experience, so it was a very big step for him. Bronwyn was tempted to join him on one of the race's 13 legs, but didn't want to have to do all the necessary training. "It's not a very pleasant way of racing either," she added. "You're at 45-degree angle most of the time. They don't shower or change their clothes much. It's an endurance race, really." Bronwyn decided to travel and meet John for the first few races and see how it worked out and if their business could survive her being overseas for so long. As well as working for around 2 days a week answering emails and speaking to people to manage their property business and also maintain their coaching business, teaching people how to invest in property to free up their time, she did various voluntary jobs, including 2 weeks at the animal sanctuary in Nairobi that she had dreamt of volunteering at, and 3 weeks planting trees with conservation volunteers in New Zealand. For Bronwyn, the really special thing was being there to meet John at the end of every race. "I really wanted to be there to welcome the yachts and make it more special for John," she said. "When you're finishing a tough race, it helps to know there is someone there waiting for you." Bronwyn admits that she didn't always feel comfortable about John getting back on the boat either. "The race can be dangerous, and participants have died, including Simon Spears, who was racing on one of the other boats at the same time as John." "I did have my misgivings," said Bronwyn. "More people have climbed Everest than have circumnavigated the world on a yacht." The couple had between 3 and 10 days together at each stop, depending on where John's yacht came in the previous race. They flew Bronwyn's children, Robert, 24, and Laura, 21, out to Sydney to spend Christmas together. Bronwyn and John encouraged Robert and Laura to spend the year having adventures of their own as well. Bronwyn said, "Robert went to the Everest base camp and spent 6 months travelling, and Laura went to Madrid to learn Spanish and lived in Tenerife for a while." Bronwyn said that it had been hugely valuable for her and John, who have been married for 13 years, to each have their own adventures. "I miss John at times, especially if they were having difficulties," she said. "Part of our challenge now the race is over will be being together more. We might have to find time to be apart, but the experience has definitely brought us closer together." The couple now plan to write parallel books about their adventures and to travel more. And there are several pictures, one big one of her and John. I can't see where it is, but obviously at some stop. One selfie of her on the Great Wall of China. One with a great sign and a group of people, "Welcome to all the crews from Clipper," which I suppose was, again, meeting her husband. And another selfie of her on the edge of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. So a pretty big adventure.
Auditors happy with City Council. Winchester City Council has been given a clean bill of health in a recent external audit. The Council's external auditors have reviewed its financial statements and have concluded that they will issue an unqualified opinion that they have found very few amendments that need to be made. The Council has had to deliver its financial statements in record speed with a deadline brought forward for the final report by a month compared to last year, with a further month less for the external audit. The auditors also provided an unqualified opinion on the Council's arrangements for securing value for money by declaring a no matter to report conclusion. Councillor Guy Ashton, portfolio holder for finance, said, "This positive report is a result of a significant amount of planning and preparation from the Council to meet the government's new shorter deadlines. I am very pleased that our finance team has risen to the challenge."
An early arrival at the Watercress line. A dad had a trip he'll never forget after travelling to Oldsford with his wife and two children, only to return home with a third. After deciding to take a day trip to see Thomas the Tank Engine at the Watercress line, panic broke out as his wife, Malali, went into labour. Despite not being due until August 20th, she gave birth in around 15 minutes, shortly after arriving at the Oldsford railway station. But Hassan, who lives 2.5 hours away in Essex with the rest of the family, says baby Mariah is doing well after the drama. He said, "When we got there, she went into labour. I had two children with me and my wife, who was about to give birth. Panicking, Hassan said he had to try to get his children, who were getting distressed in the chaos, to calm down, while also tending to his wife. He said, "Luckily, we were at a quiet end of the station. I called for an ambulance, which arrived within 10 minutes. When they came, they realised that my newborn's head was coming out. They said, 'We have to deliver the baby here.' But when the paramedics told Hassan 5 minutes later he was a father to another girl, he said, it was just such a relief. Everyone was amazing. People who didn't know me were congratulating me." He said that his wife's labour of around 15 minutes compared to 14 hours for his 3-year-old son Umar and 10 hours for his 1-year-old daughter Rabia. Hassan was also full of praise for volunteers at the Watercress line, the steam railway that runs from Oldsford through to Alton. He said, "The station manager took my little ones and allowed them to pick any toy from the gift shop. We are thinking about holding her first birthday party there." Following the drama, Watercress line general manager Jason Holders said, "I'm proud of what all our volunteers achieve every day, but this really was something very special. We are delighted that mother and baby are fine and looking forward to welcoming the family back to the Watercress line for a more relaxing visit in the coming months." And there's a photograph of Malali and Hassan Ali with their newborn baby girl, Mariah. Beautiful photograph, lovely little child. And as an inset, there's a photograph of Thomas the Tank Engine at Oldsford. And on the front of the engine is the face, the famous face. But this one has a very surprised look.
Teen attacked by man at skate park. A man launched an unprovoked attack on an innocent teenager during a confrontation in a skate park. Kyle McGailey left his then 14-year-old victim, who cannot be identified for legal reasons, with a fractured nose and in need of an operation after he headbutted and punched him. The 21-year-old admitted assaulting the victim after thinking he was someone else during the incident at Free Space Skate Park in Chandler's Ford. Southampton Crown Court heard that McGailey, who is already serving a 41-month jail term for a similar grievous bodily harm charge, saw the victim and a group of friends hanging out at the park. Prosecutor Nicholas Hall said, Magaly grabbed the victim, headbutted him, then punched him in the nose. He then said to the victim, if you do anything like this again, I'll kill you. In an impact statement, the victim said, I am scared to go out at night and only go out with my friends if they come with me. Magaly was jailed for 14 months.
Drones to track rail line problems. Drones are to be used to give an aerial view of possible problems on the region's rail network. The very first network rail drone survey on the southwestern rail route has taken place to improve performance and safety. The drone will fly up to 120 metres high at speeds of up to 50 miles per hour. The image it takes, such as illegal trespassing, can be immediately transferred to the British Transport Police. Network Rail's mobile incident officer, Peter Atkins, is the first trained railway drone pilot on the route from Waterloo Station to the South Coast. He completed extensive training with Essex Police before qualifying to fly. The drone is equipped with a high-tech heat-sensitive camera to spot changes in temperature, helping identify people and potential damage to our infrastructure. It will also allow inspections to be carried out without closing the line. Southwestern Railway Managing Director Andy Mellors said, trespassing on the railway network can give tragic consequences and cause unnecessary delays. I hope that the deployment of this new technology will discourage trespassing and reduce delays.
Student jailed for stealing from TK Maxx's new store. A student who systematically stole more than £20,000 from the high street chain where he worked has been jailed for 16 months. Misael de Medeiros admitted stealing both money and goods from TK Maxx in Winchester just weeks after starting a job there. Winchester Crown Court heard how the 26-year-old student at Winchester University began stealing after no one questioned him over a wrong refund. He went on to steal at least £23,000 through false refunds and several hundred pounds in cash and items of clothes and jewellery between April and July. However, Charles Gabb, prosecuting, said he did not accept that figure, the basis on which De Medeiros pleaded guilty, alleging it was, in fact, in excess of £25,000. Mr. Gabb added that on two occasions, De Medeiros had worked with another man, who is yet to be identified, to steal from the store that had only been open in the Brooks Shopping Centre for a few weeks. Mitigating, Lance Whiteford said that when De Medeiros had come to England aged 15, he couldn't speak a word of English, but he worked hard and became the first member of his family to go to university. Mr. Whiteford added, he is someone who expresses remorse. He is someone who acted out of greed. He wanted to stop, but he got used to the money. The court also heard that although De Medeiros, who has previous convictions for shoplifting in 2010 and 2011, spent some of the money on socialising, he gave money to his family and used it to pay off gambling debts. Sentencing De Medeiros of Church Lane, Kingsworthy, Judge Susan Evans, QC, said, over a period of some 4 months, you systematically defrauded your employer. You started work in April, and within weeks you began this course of dishonesty. You had worked hard to better yourself. No doubt you would have had a good future. A proceeds of crime hearing has been scheduled for January the 24th.
Festival of Gin. Gin lovers will have the opportunity to enjoy a superb selection of gins from the UK and overseas during an 11-day festival at the Old Jailhouse. The pub in Jury Street, Winchester, will be serving gins from Japan, Portugal, Spain, Germany and Italy, as well as gins produced in the UK. The festival runs from Friday, August the 17th to Monday, August the 27th. There will be numerous award-winning gins among the selection, as well as a choice of flavoured gins. The five overseas gins are Gin Mare, Spain, Roku, Japan, Monkey 47 Schwarzwald Dry Gin, Germany, Charisse Blue Magic Gin, Portugal, and Malfi Gin con Limone, Italy. I'm testing myself on this one.
You're testing us as well.
The UK gins will include Jawbox Single Dry Gin, Mason's Dry Yorkshire Gin, Wrecking Coast Clotted Cream Gin, Brecon Special Reserve, Finney's Black Bee Gin, and Bathtub Gin. Old jailhouse manager Hannah Barrett said, "The majority of gins in the festival have not been available in the pub beforehand, and I'm looking forward to serving them. The festival promises to be great fun, and I'm certain that our customers will enjoy trying the superb range of gins that we have on offer. Tasting notes on all of the gins will be available in the pub." I think Gordon's is about my lot.
Family angered by report into soldier's death on range. The family of a soldier who died during an army training exercise have had a report into his death raising unanswered questions. Lance Corporal Joe Spencer of the 3rd Battalion the Rifles died at RAF Tain in the Scottish Highlands on November the 1st, 2016. A report by the Defence Safety Authority said there had been a series of errors, shortfalls and poor judgment at the training exercise and described his death as an avoidable accident. But the family of the 24-year-old from Bishopstoke had been left disappointed by the report, which they said raised numerous unanswered questions due to the abundance of unsubstantiated speculation and assumptions and the factual inaccuracies and inconsistencies. In a statement, they said they had been extremely upset that the report had been published despite their questions when they were shown the conclusion last month, to which they said they had not received a response. They said it's clear to us the individuals responsible for delivering the sniper training course did not do so in accordance with the mandated course syllabus and requisite rules and regulations. We strongly believe Joe would still be with us today if they had, added the family. The soldier's partner, Charisse Connolly, said, "The report details far more failings than we could ever have anticipated, and to say I'm both angry and disappointed with its findings would be an understatement." The 24-year-old who lives in Dundee added, "Joe deserved better. He was not on active deployment in a war zone. He was in training where risk to life should have been minimal. Joe should have come home." The report published on Thursday said the soldier died after his rifle discharged as he rested his chin on the weapon. It said whilst resting his chin on the weapon suppressor equipment or clothing most probably snagged in the rifle's trigger inadvertently, resulting in its discharge. That his weapon was in an unsafe condition with a round chambered was extremely likely to have been caused by an incomplete unload drill being carried out earlier that day. The report said poor supervision and a failure to follow mandated procedures were themes of the service inquiry report and added that the post-accident response fell short in a number of areas.
Hants captains to be reunited at the bowl. Hampshire cricket. Hampshire legend Robin Smith is training to become a psychologist to help sportsmen avoid the difficulties he has encountered since his career ended 15 years ago. Smith, who admits to struggling with mental health issues since his distinguished Hampshire career ended in 2003. Will be returning to the Aegis Bowl on Tuesday, August the 28th. The former England batsman spoke of his passion to help others fill the void once their playing career is over, ahead of his eagerly anticipated return. All 12 surviving Hampshire captains, including Smith and Shane Warne, will be at a captain's dinner at the Aegis Bowl in a fortnight's time. Speaking to his former teammate, Kevin James, who will be hosting the event, Smith revealed, "I'm currently studying to be a psychologist, and the plan is to qualify in 3.5 years' time. There is such a deep process in trying to get over professional sport. I find mental health incredibly interesting and have suffered severely from that for some time since finishing from cricket. I'm thoroughly enjoying the course and just wish I'd taken this up towards the back end of my career. I approached the England selectors in 1991 to 1992 about having a sports psychologist in our dressing room, but it was poo-pooed. It was a shame because a lot of players would have been much better with a sports psychologist within our midst. Many would have benefited from it. Just look at how Mike Brearley brought out the best in Ian Botham. Beefy admits he wouldn't be the player he was without Mike. Smith, who played for England from 1988 to 1993 and captained Hampshire from 1998 to 2002, has lived in Australia since his playing days ended. The 54-year-old said, "I'm finding the course very challenging. I found it hard enough to retain information at 16, so it's very difficult now, and the vocabulary in my textbooks is very different to the words we used in the Hampshire dressing room." But when you've had that practical experience, learning the theory is incredibly interesting. Smith is also writing a book revealing his struggles. "If you don't prepare for life after sport, you're in serious trouble," he continued. "I'm writing an autobiography where I talk a lot about how difficult it is to cope once you finish something that's absorbed most of your life. One of the hardest things is accepting the time has come to end your professional career." Members' tickets for the captain's dinner are available at £75 per person. Standard tickets are available at £85 per person or £800 for a table of 10. Contact the Aegis Bowl ticket office on 02380 472 002, option 2, via tickets at aegisbowl.com, or in person during normal working hours between Monday and Friday. And there's a photograph of the face of Robin Smith, smiling away. Doesn't look a year older than when I last saw him play cricket.
A woman was found dead at her Winchester home after taking an overdose, an inquest heard. Amanda Dewhurst, 42, was discovered at the Lime Tree Walk property where she lived alone by her husband, lives close by with their son. The inquest heard that she had last been seen by a neighbour on March the 12th, 2 days before. Paul Dewhurst had gone round to check on her as usual, but could only see through the window that the TV was on. Becoming concerned, he managed to move the curtain slightly to get a better look, seeing her on the bed, and he called police to break in. The inquest heard that Mrs. Dewhurst had suffered mental and physical health issues, as well as alcohol dependency. She sought help from the Southern Health Trust and Addiction Service Inclusion, but it proved unsuccessful. Pathologist Dr. Hayley Burnley said there was no alcohol in her body, but there was evidence of prescription medication and morphine. She said that it was this combination that caused her death, although the inquest heard that she had only been prescribed morphine once in December, raising questions over the source of the drug. Recording a conclusion of drugs-related death, Coroner Graham Short said, "I find the most plausible explanation for the high level of morphine in her blood to be that she acquired it illegally. He added that although it was possible that she intended to take her life, there was no evidence of intention. And there is a picture of Lime Tree Walk, which is a beautiful, wide, airy-looking street in Winnall.
Red Cross trolley teams at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital have been raising funds towards a much-needed hospice. Some £2.5 million is needed to open the 10-bed Burrell House Hospice in the grounds of the hospital in early 2019. Already £1.1 million has been raised, but another £500,000 is needed before work can start. Jean Lee, the Red Cross trolley shop manager, handed over a cheque for £500 to Judith Charmer, the fundraising manager. Jean said, "We would like to have been in a position to give more, but we have already funded other hospital departments this year. As the Dalai Lama said, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. How very true, as the trolley shop isn't large. We try to keep prices low and don't aim to make a great profit. But every donation, however small, gets a total a bit nearer to the ultimate goal. We are a team of 12 volunteers visiting the wards every Monday and Wednesday afternoon. So do please support us. And there's a picture of Judith Charmer and Jean Lee, the Red Cross trolley manager, and volunteers Sharon Stokes, Pat Cook and John Lee.
Thank you. And that concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors, Margaret Boyden and Linda Vincent. Thanks to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And of course, thanks to our readers, Nikki Baring.
Goodbye.
Norma York.
Goodbye.
And Albie Minns.
Goodbye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye. And do have an enjoyable week. And when you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.